for game five tonight in Boston. Good morning, Brent.
Yeah, good morning, Ben. Could be the end of an era. Good job, by our man Comandrew on the wheels of steel today. And yeah, with or without you, I didn't even pick that up. So good job by you noting that to me. God, it's going to be a long day of this. I'm like excited to do the show. I'm always happy to talk to you, but this will shock you. My Leafs speculating and worrying does not end at 8:55 every morning. It's going to be a pensive day of. Anybody got any scuttlebutt around the Leafs? Waiting to see whether or not Matthews plays in the potentially last game of the season.
Who'd have thunk that the William Nylander extravaganza and everything that surrounded that, not the least of which is him not missing a single game over the last 8 years in non-COVID circumstances, playing all 82 this season, and then missing the first three games of this series, would be like the secondary weirdo injury being held out of a lineup story. Somebody is going to have to explain to me, like, honestly, the Nylander thing, now that we have at least a potential reason that seems like it was confirmed that it was the migraine thing. Okay, a lot of pieces are starting to fall into place there, right? Yeah. Somebody's going to have to explain to me. So, Austin Matthews played in game three a week ago tomorrow. So we heard talk of this illness the day prior. So that was a week ago today.
Right.
So since these symptoms evolved, and he played spectacularly in game two a week ago yesterday. So somebody's going to have to explain to me, and I'm not saying that there isn't an explanation. I would just love to hear it. Somebody's going to have to explain to me how a guy can play a game, that's game three,
that's
and
true.
Then two-thirds of a game in game four. Now, granted, not super well, especially grading on a scale of what we saw that is possible from the 69-goal regular season goal scorer in game two, where he single-handedly won them the game, was in on all three goals, including scoring the game winner in the third period. Somebody's going to have to explain to me how this player can play in one full game and two-thirds of another, and a week later, the symptoms getting worse and worse and worse to the extent at which he's possibly, and boy, the way they're working their line rushes yesterday in practice, it's not like there's a placeholder in place. They're like, this is what it could look like without Austin Matthews. Somebody's going to have to explain to me how this illness has gotten worse to the extent at which the best player on this team in the most important game and possibly final game of the season might miss it because of illness. I'm not saying that there isn't a reason, but I, for my money, that's unprecedented.
We have to talk about the lore of the sport at this time of year. You know, now that we have again, you mentioned Nylander, I guess unconfirmed but non-denied report of migraine, which I feel like is as good a report as we're going to get at this time of year. Like, there has not been hard denials that that's what it's been. So I think we're safe to say that maybe the idea that, and again, you can say these things or talk about them in a way. You understand migraines, okay, but some people look at that and go, Bobby Bond scored a goal on a broken leg, and this player had a headache.
Sure.
Austin Matthews, and again, I want to be clear. I don't think Austin Matthews is sitting there able to play and going, no, I can't. I can't. They're going, come on, let's pump you full of IVs. And go, no, I just can't. I don't think that's happening. But it is so hard to wrap your mind around Bobby Bond scoring a goal on a broken leg or Patrice Bergeron playing through a punctured lung. And there are all these stories. Again, it's like the Johnny Bauer going to war story. It's like it starts as one thing and then it becomes infinitely worse as we move on throughout history.
Yeah.
But it is so hard to square in the lore of the sport and what we talk about and what we value and guys blocking shots with their face.
Yeah.
That he has food poisoning, or he's sick, or it's a viral bug. And I am not saying that this is a player pulling himself out of the series. Of course I'm not. But I need a detailed explanation more so than the tilapia was a little off.
Well,
I need that.
And maybe he plays tonight and it's all rendered moot. But like I said, this is different than the first go around here, where Connor Dewar's in his spot on the top line, where it's like, okay, I don't think Connor Dewar's centering.
Yeah, it's not my name, Cade Weber up there,
right? No, it's Max Domi next to Tyler Bertuzzi and Mitch Marner, and it's like, okay, well,
that looks like a line.
That could be it. Okay, so I mean, I guess we got to revisit game four before we think about game five here and, yep. and what took place there. I am all for medical intervention to remove a player from a hockey game due to concussions, due to head injury stuff. Yep. You know why? Because that impacts the rest of your life. Head injuries, concussions, things of that nature. If you continue to play with them and perhaps suffer a second concussion, not only is your career in jeopardy, like the quality of life that you expect to live for 40 plus years beyond your hockey playing days is in jeopardy.
Go look at the NFL. Forget the quality. Just making it 40 years, like CTE, all that stuff. Like,
100%. Yeah, so when you tell me that the doctors have removed Austin Matthews from a game that was is not over, despite the fact that it felt over through 40 minutes on Saturday, it was factually not. It was only a three-goal hockey game for the second highest scoring team in the regular season.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mitch Marner scores the goal, and the momentum seems like it's shifting. You know, it would have been helpful to have the 69-goal score.
I think.
But what you're telling us by saying that the doctors removed him from that hockey game is that there's a fear of, like, long-term problems for Austin Matthews if he plays in the hockey game, because you're not just going to remove no doctor's going to tell the head coach of a National Hockey League team that its best player can't play just because, you know, we think he's actually, you know, he's too sick, we got to protect him from himself. What are you talking about? If you want to play and you're capable of playing again, it didn't look like the same dude that we saw in game two, that we saw in the entirety of game three in the first two periods of game four. But if he felt up to it, yeah, in the history of the sport, there's never been somebody who, you know, doctors have put the Heisman up and said, forget it. Why? Because you're afraid he's going to vomit on the ice? Like, that part is just head-scratching for me.
Yeah, and, like, I don't want to sit here and play, you know, guessing armchair doctor, whatever you want to call it. Like, it keeps coming back to the messaging for me. Mm-hmm. And I understand. Cloak of secrecy. No one's going to come out and say, all right, let me, Austin, come stand here. And he's going to get out like his like pointer, like he's teaching a professor. He's got a laser pointer out and he goes, see this area? I'm going to circle it right here. This is where the pain is on Austin. We understand the cloak and dagger that happens at this time of year, but it can't get away from the messaging. If this is some type of, I don't know, like internal infection or something. That is the only thing I can think of that rises to the serious level of.
Yeah.
Because again, and I understand that Sheldon Keefe has bigger fish to fry right now. Like the biggest thing he should be worried about is having his team ready, systems wise, emotion wise, whatever way you want to look at it, for game five tonight against the Bruins. That's the most important thing. But coming out and again, the idea, and I understand you're just trying to be wishy-washy, you're trying to give us something so we can stop asking questions about it, but it's Toronto and it's Austin Matthews, so that doesn't work. Food poisoning and a bug are just so hard to wrap your head around.
I'm telling you.
It's impossible to wrap your head around, and if I, quite honestly, if I was Matthews, and I think part of the belief of why he can thrive in this market is water off a duck's back, doesn't worry so much. If I was Matthews, I would be screaming from the rooftops. Again, not necessarily exactly what it is, but it's not a tummy ache. I don't have food poisoning. And I don't know, maybe he does, but I find it so hard to believe. And this is the thing is, and again, maybe this is great that we're spending the whole day today talking about what mystery ailment Austin Matthews has instead of the fact that the era of the Leafs could very well end tonight.
You ever had food poisoning?
I don't know that, well, like, how does it work? Like, I don't go to the doctor and they say you just have to
guess. You have to guess. You ate something. You're like, oh, that was it. Like, you can feel it. I've had it once in my life, and I was like, oh, I'm going to die for one night.
Yeah.
But then it was over. Like, it was like nothing
happened.
Didn't last
a week.
No, it was like nothing happened the next day. Literally, we're talking about a week here. And a week. Okay, so the symptoms first arise at some point after the game on Monday, which was, again, a week yesterday. Austin Matthews was the greatest player this postseason has seen. Okay? Yep. The next day, symptoms emerge, and then the day after that, a week ago tomorrow, he plays through whatever he's dealing with. We're a week on, and he's going to potentially miss game. But again, like, maybe it's all moot, and we don't need to talk about it because he's going to play in the hockey game, but they're giving us every indication that they're looking pretty seriously at the possibility of not having him
tonight. It also feels, again, it's impossible not to tie the Nylander situation and this one together. And correct me if I'm wrong, God, it feels like the longest week and a half, whatever it's been since the start of this series, but it always felt like Nylander, it was more of a hopeful tone. Like, yeah, we'll see. He's skating. We'll see. And I think part of that was the cat and mouse game with Boston early on in the series. But with Matthews, I mean, you know, his Keith's comments post-game were one thing, but the comments yesterday, the line rushes yesterday, if he plays tonight, I think that it'll surprise the team and it'll surprise Boston. Like, it really, really feels like, and who knows, but this doesn't feel like they're, you know, playing possum with the Bruins here. They're trying to psych somebody out. I think they really are prepping for the fact that he ain't going tonight.
Yeah, it seems pretty clear. All right, so let's discuss that possibility. Mm-hmm. And for a team that has failed to score more than two goals in a hockey game, save for one game where they scored three, the one that they won.
Yeah, and he scored or had the primary assist on all of them.
That's correct. Right. Feels like a significant loss to a team that needs to score. Now, I mean,
I just want to say, like, I'm so lucky to get to work with you that you would come to that conclusion that, like, it would be hard for the Leafs to score that Austin Matthews. I'm so lucky.
Yeah, you're welcome. But this is also a Leafs team that has a tremendous record without Austin Matthews.
Weird.
So the regular season we view differently. You have to.
You think.
you got no choice. But Brent, God, it felt like after game two, the possibility of Austin Matthews single-handedly winning this series, it would like just only add to the lore of this entire season, the 69 goals during the regular season. If he doesn't play tonight, or he's some diminished version of himself, and we just have the game two to look back on, and it's a first-round exit, will that change the way you view the greatest goal-scoring season in the history of this franchise, one of the greatest in the recent history of the National Hockey League?
It is wholly dependent on what the explanation is that comes out of whatever this sickness is. And I guess it shouldn't be me to be the arbiter, but I think we're all going to have a... we're all going to have a think on this one when it comes out, when we get the final diagnosis or whatever it was that was keeping him out. I don't think, and maybe you feel differently, I don't think that Matthews would be suddenly healthy today if he hadn't played in games 81 and 82 pushing for goal 70. I don't think that's how it works, especially with the world's most mysterious infection. You know, the Nylander thing, he takes a hit, maybe that leads to a migraine. We can have those discussions. I think that's fair to have. But I think that it is almost, and he wouldn't look at it this way, it's almost a silver lining. You cannot put the failure of the first round on him. He was, if it plays out the way that it is entirely possible, he doesn't play tonight, they lose. I actually think they win either way tonight, but we'll park that.
Actually think he plays tonight too.
Okay. I don't think he plays. And I think it's a classic Leafs back against the wall, like Connor Dewar one in one night or something like that. But I think that he has been spared wearing this series to a certain extent. If it ends tonight and he doesn't play, then we're living in a world where he played 3.5 healthy games of the series and won one of them single-handedly. You can have your qualms about how he performed in the rest of those games, but
I mean,
that's a pretty good ratio.
He played two fully healthy games,
and
right?
One of them he won single-handedly. So pretty good ratio. I think that's the thing. It's like there will always be people who go, look at this. Classic Leaf season. It's actually the perfect Leaf season. Mm. You do a whole bunch when it doesn't matter and nothing when you do. And for those people, there's nothing that can make them change their mind. But I actually think this specific way it is playing out, he wouldn't sign up for it. He doesn't want this, but it kind of, to a certain extent, as much as can be possible for the de facto captain of the team and the highest paid player in the league, as much as possible, this absolves him to a certain extent.
Yeah, I couldn't disagree more. I mean, especially again, like I don't know what the explanation would be for this illness thing that's gone for longer than a week and has gotten worse, that it would, you know, like, well, you know what?
Okay.
We should have never even talked about the Jordan flu game,
right?
Or like Pete Sampras throwing up in the middle of a US Open final. Like that was silly, because this thing that he had was like, oh my God, I can't believe he was able to stand up. But I mean, what we're likely looking at is, just some illness, I guess, right? Like, That's basically what Sheldon Keefe said. It's like, it's not like it's presenting itself as a bizarre illness that continues to get worse. And, you know, the harder he works, the more it presents its symptoms. It's going to be hard, I think, for Leaf fans to ever reference this season and the 69 goals, because the retort will always be, oh, yeah, the season in which Austin Matthews, you know, cost his team a chance at advancing because he had a tummy ache, because he missed game five, because he opted out of the final period of a close game in game four. I'm sorry. Yeah. Like, that's what I keep coming back to. So, I wish I had an explanation with the team, and I wish, again, I'm open to the possibility of that, but it's hard, man. It is hard.
So I wholeheartedly agree with you. If the explanation is, and look, they're going to say it in like a super medical way, but if the explanation is tummy ache, then no, there is nothing, there is nothing that he could have done in the regular season that would paper over this. But, and again, I have no inside information. What if it is one of, and it's like, I'm not a doctor, so I don't even know how important these things are or aren't. Mm. What if it's one of those like B or C class organs inside the body? Like, I don't know, like a gallbladder or something. And it ruptured. The doctor's pulling him out of the game.
Well, that would be, yeah.
Yeah. That's what I'm getting at, though. I refuse to believe, and I'm about to say, feel free to prove me wrong, but please, God, don't prove me wrong in this. I refuse to believe they looked at the vitals and they went, God, he's sweaty. Give him an Advil and tuck him in. He's too tired.
Well, if it's that serious,
I refuse to believe
though,
that. But then that's why I don't think he's playing tonight.
But if it was that serious, okay, why is he playing in game three at all or the first two thirds of game
four? You want to know why?
And why is he traveling to Boston?
Do you
want to
know why?
Like, if he's having an internal organ removed tomorrow if they lose.
Just literal baseless speculation, because I think that's the level it has to get to for people to find it palatable. But also, why? Because it's the cup, because of the standard we hold these guys to at this time of year. Idea, well, why would he play? Well, because it's the playoffs. I am not blind to the reality that the Leafs can come out with an explanation for this that does not pass muster and does not make anybody feel any better and becomes a bit of a black eye on the player that will never be removed until there's ultimate team success. I'm not blind to that reality. Mm-hmm. I'm also not willing to 100% cast dispersion there on the one guy who's kind of brought it at every time that you've needed to, and the one guy that's brought it in this series to literally single-handedly win you a game.
So, yeah, Austin Matthews missed the practice after the incredible game two, right? And we heard talk of this illness in game three. Grant, again, like, effectiveness, not that. He played over 23 minutes in the hockey game. Had three shots on goal. Like, wasn't the same Austin Matthews. He played 23 minutes.
Right.
Game four, the first two periods of the hockey game, played over 14 minutes. He only had one shot on goal. Played 14 minutes. Like, he's on pace again to play 20 minutes in the hockey game. Like, physically played.
Because it's the cup.
Yeah. But for some reason, the third period is like a bridge too far. And then like given like an extra day off in the series again, before game five in Boston tonight. I don't understand.
That is why
I understand it even less than the Nylander. The Nylander thing makes perfect sense.
It's like
now,
he wasn't playing. He's playing.
Yeah. He couldn't. He had to wear sunglasses indoors. Like, he couldn't, like, light was a problem for him.
Yep.
And he's like, hey, can we play this game in the dark? And they're like, no. So he's like, then I got to hold myself out because I'm literally cannot operate because I have debilitating migraines.
I think, and again, like, I always want to be right, but I need to be right on this one because it is like, this is the like Max Kellerman clip about Iguodala taking the shot. It's like literal fate of the universe stuff is on the line here right now, okay? I actually kind of think, the more I think about this, I need Austin Matthews not to play tonight. Because if he plays, then there is no clean breaking point. Like, I have to live in a world where it was a hard and fast, again, like, I go to, like, a rupturing of something. And I don't mean, like, a tendon. I mean something that you need to, like, keep the machine ticking. Again, this will shock you guys. Not a doctor. But I think it's almost more damning if he does play tonight. Now, I don't think he would sit just because it looks more damning or bad or anything along those lines. I refuse to believe that. But, man, this is a... It's so funny that we're sitting here talking about the game tonight, and all I can think about is the explanation we get about for Austin Matthews' tummy or whatever's
going
on.
Well, I mean, for us who've sat through a decade of post-postseason media availabilities. That is an interesting wrinkle, and it's a little different. So, like, you know, that'll be a different answer.
Yeah.
Anyways, so let's talk about the way this team could line up tonight without Austin Matthews. Mm-hmm. Again, like, they're giving us every indication that they're very attuned to the possibility of having no Austin Matthews.
They played one game without him this year. Do you remember what it was?
I don't.
It was the second greatest game of the season. The greatest game of the season was the punch up against the Canucks before they sent him away.
Was that the first Bobby McMahon hat trick?
No, that was the routing of Kyle Dubas and Jason Spezza at home on, I don't know if it was Hockey Night, but it sounds better when I say it this way, on Hockey Night in Canada, when Matthew Knies had a Gordie Howe hat trick and the Leafs drubbed the Pens 7-0. That was the one game they played without Matthews this year.
The Bobby McMahon game, they were without everybody else.
Yes. Somehow he played.
No Mitch Marner, no John Tavares.
Yeah, because Matthews had the hat trick the game before, and it's like, even for a guy who is you know, sick in the playoffs and can't play, it's tough to take the game off after a hat trick.
I joke, people.
Anyways,
I'm defending him today, so I'm allowed to make that joke, okay?
Tyler Bertuzzi, Max Domi, Mitch Marner is your top line tonight, Brent.
Yep.
How do you feel about that?
I think this is a massive spot for the right winger on that top line. Max Domi and Tyler Bertuzzi, I don't know about you. I will hold them accountable. They are top line forwards on this team. Mm-hmm. They're not the guys that are supposed to drive that line. One guy's playing a position he hasn't played in months on this team, and the other guy is playing with a guy he has had minimal chemistry with when playing with him this year, and Bertuzzi and Marner together. I think this puts a big spotlight on Marner. I don't think there's any other way I'd go about it, but you know, Domi's a great passer. Him and Marner should be able to thrive off of one another in theory. But yeah, if there's no Matthews and Max Domi is your number one center, you need Mitch Marner to be great. Like, I don't want to make this about, well, that one guy has to step up. Because guess what? If there's no Matthews, so does Tavares. If there's no Matthews, so does Nylander. Mm-hmm. But Marner is going to have to be the driver of that line, and Domi is going to be a guy who is playing out of position. And man, like, we can even have that conversation. Not that the Leafs wanted to use Domi as a center, but they certainly went away from it a ton. This was part of the plan early on in the season. Did not work, went away from it. I liked the spot they found for him, but this is the problem with the lack of center depth the Leafs have, is you're throwing a guy in there who, yeah, he's comfortable in the position, but when was the last time he took a regular shift as center for this hockey team?
No, it's been a while.
Yeah.
It really has. It was he took his first tour of duty in the middle of the ice when he had a slow start of the season. Yep. And was waited to get him going. Now he finds himself centering the top line of the Toronto Maple Leafs in an elimination game in Boston. They did play, this line played 3 minutes and 28 seconds together this season. Had pretty good results.
Yep.
They outscored opponents 1-0 in that span, and shot share, they controlled it. I don't hate it, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
I think the chemistry between Bertuzzi and Domi is real. I think Domi's postseason has been underwhelming, mostly because of the undisciplined penalties mm-hmm. he's taken. But other than that, I've actually liked those guys, the way they've looked together. And yeah, you got the defensive conscious that is Mitch Marner. It's a little different than mm-hmm. the guy that's playing up the middle, but yeah, kind of a same similar type mentality as having Austin Matthews between a couple of offensive players and Bertuzzi and Domi.
Yeah, the only other thing you could have done there is put Knies in that spot, because again, that's who was in that spot alongside Domi and Marner for that Pittsburgh game. But I think that you really like the way Bertuzzi's going. You like how engaged he's been. And I also think you have to realize what they're going to get. It's going to be, you'd imagine, healthy dose of Marchand against those guys. That's been a matchup Montgomery has kind of loved, just staying in Bertuzzi's kitchen with him. And so I think that you kind of need Bertuzzi to stick on that line as well. And I like Knies with Tavares and Willie. I think it is what it is at this point. It's a second line that has a rookie, an aging center, and a 40-goal man. And honestly, like, we get so used to the idea of super lines here.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what your second line's supposed to look like. I mean, we'd all love the two-headed monster you're supposed to have, but, you know, 70-point center, solid two-way guy in Tavares. Like, he has his deficiencies in terms of skating, but 70-point player, William Nylander, 40-goal guy, and then a young power forward rookie.
Oh, yeah, it definitely should be enough. I mean, you'd like to have the
Well, it's no Mason Lauri.
Yeah, sure.
Or, you know, Leaf killer Jake DeBrusk.
Uh-huh. No, it should be enough. Obviously, nothing has been so far through five games. TJ Brody understandably also not amongst the six defensemen that will play tonight after his minus two game in his return to the lineup in game four. And like, not just minus two, like directly responsible for a 2-on-0 and a puck in the back of the net. Gotta figure, Brent, after seeing him play in that hockey game, that even if the Leafs extend this series, and even if like Timothy Liljegren suffers an injury, like that, it's quite possible, and especially considering he's a pending free agent.
Yep.
That's the end of the TJ Brody era. I mean, how will you look back on it?
I look back on it as kind of what you get when you sign a upper middle class free agent. There's going to be some really good years in there where, I mean, we spent the first 2.5 years of the TJ Brody contract talking about how does that guy only make $5 million, and then kind of fell off a cliff a little bit. This is what happens when you shop in the soon-to-be 30 free agent waters, see your second-line center making $11 million now. This is kind of how it goes. You know, I still think that it's something you would do all over again. And he is also, I know this isn't exactly what you're asking me, but he is also the poster child for how you come into an org affects the way you are viewed, because, you know, it's never been 100% confirmed, but we all believe there was that possible Kadri Brody trade that kind of got scuttled. If TJ Brody came in here as the key piece, the crown jewel of a Nazem Kadri trade, still like him, still happy with the player, especially if you re-sign him for roughly that deal. But it's never the same as, oh, my God, look at this found money for $5 million in free agency.
We never had to deal with the Tyson Berry situation, though.
Yeah, but it wouldn't have been as bad. But the idea that TJ Brody would have been viewed as just this incredible stalwart, you know what he'd be viewed as? Not a top pair defenseman. That's what he would have been viewed as the whole time.
I don't know, man. I think that the TJ Brody era, like starting in the postseason last year, because the warts started to show up, right? Yep. When he and Jake McCabe couldn't hack it as the shutdown pairing, and then carrying over to the entirety of this regular season, culminating in a game one healthy scratch, and then, you know, an attempt to like regain what you had in game four, and obviously to not being there. This is the first time, like starting in the postseason this season. Mm-hmm. Before that, he was unbelievable.
No, he's been great. But my point is that a free agent that you pay $5 million that you got for nothing, and he can be Mr. Fix-It on the blue line. Again, Morgan Riley, this is like a completely different conversation because the team's completely different, but it's not Morgan Riley's fault he's not a number one defenseman, but because no one's ever been close to as good since he's been here, we go, you know what? What's wrong with you? Why aren't you a number one defenseman? Because Morgan Riley's here, we look at TJ Brody and we go, look at you, Mr. Fix-It can bounce up and down. But if you trade him for Nazem Kadri and it's, hey, this is your top pair defenseman, I'm not saying it would have been a Larry Murphy or Justin Hall situation, but I do think he's viewed in a very, very different light. And it's not that it was ever kid gloves with Brody, because there wasn't much to criticize, quite frankly, from the first 2.5 years. But I do think there's the element of coming in as found money and free and all that.
I mean, the argument that would lead to your conclusion would be that would have affected his play. Like, if he just gives you the same level of play and he's the guy that was traded for Nazem Kadri as opposed to Tyson Berry, who was like negative.
But you're all okay. So you have it's so funny the way we view things, right? It's like, you can't stop comparing him to Tyson Berry. And I'm going, there's no Tyson Berry in this world, so where you go, look at this.
You're right, of course.
But yeah, can you tell how little I want to talk about Matthews that we're down this rabbit hole?
We talked about Matthews for 20 minutes. He's playing 20 minutes a night on the top pairing. Yep. And the guy that, okay, finally somebody can play next to Morgan Riley. And like, you need somebody else going? You just put him with TJ Brody. Yep. And all of a sudden that turns into your top line. Yes, he's not Victor Hedman. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he signs I guess in this theoretical world, you get an extra year out of him, and then he signs a similar extension that he got in free agency. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, maybe he's even better. You get him in his age 29 season instead of his age 30. I'm saying that the play of the player for every season except for the last like calendar year has been unbelievable and spectacular and everything. Like, it's the one percentile outcome of acquiring the player. I don't know if there's anything to quibble with TJ Brody's play, no matter how he ends up as a Toronto Maple Leaf.
Yeah, I think we're mostly agreeing and getting hung up on, like, I don't think TJ Brody is viewed as the whipping boy or persona non grata. I think he's still very much respected. It's just he's respected now as somebody you got for free, not somebody you got for heart and soul Nazem Kadri. And again, in this hypothetical, you don't get to compare him to Tyson Barry because Barry's just somebody else. He's like Nathan McKinnon's problem this whole time. And the Avs never win a cup. Nathan McKinnon's just screaming at him like, eat chickpea salad.
Last one before we take the break.
Oh, God. Well, why couldn't they just have traded Kadri for Brody? Well,
I think we get Joe Wall tonight. I'd be floored, honestly, if we get Ilya Samsonov. And if that's it for Sammy, how will you view his tenure?
Congrats. It's what's the old Simpsons like? That's all. Farewell and good luck. I don't recall saying good luck. He did the thing. You will never be able to take away that he was the guy who won a series. This feels less and less fruitful by the day, but I still hold out belief that, you know, sometime in the somewhat distant future, we won't talk about one winning one round of a playoff series like it's 15 cups in a row. The other thing about if he goes, not to get away from the Sammy tenure question, but the other thing is if he goes to Wall tonight, that tells me everything I need to know about, like, Keith going down, swinging the way he wants. This has been the guy who's wanted to be his goalie all year long. And, like, eventually Samsonov just took the net and rightfully so won the job. But if this is Keith's last stand and he's caught no Matthews and Max Domi's his first-line center, I think he goes, you know what, let me just put the kid I have the most faith in there.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about that element of it after 7 o'clock. Yeah, to me, the Samsonov thing worked out pretty well. Like, this was a guy that you got for very little money, less than market value.
Yep.
Because he saw an opportunity splitting the net with Matt Murray and rightly probably thought Matt Murray would get hurt, which he did. And kudos to him. Seized that opportunity, played exceedingly well last season, including the six games against the Tampa Bay Lightning, out dueling, it must be said, and obviously injured Andrei Vasilevsky.
You don't have to say it.
Obviously injured. But no, like, was outstanding in game six.
Yep.
Like, just so good. And then I think the organization rightly said, okay, we'll do it again. And he couldn't.
Yep.
And then you wave farewell. But they had a backup plan in Joe Wall. We'll talk about whether they should have activated that backup plan a little earlier after 7 o'clock. But when we come back, the Blue Jays erupted.
Oh, my God.
For six runs.
It is still quaking at Rogers Center.
Justin Turner with his best game as a Blue Jay as well. Is he off to one of the best starts of any new Blue Jay in recent memory? That and more next as the Fan Morning Show continues. Ben Ennis, Brent Gunning, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Justin Turner with a couple of home runs. Blue Jays score six runs, more than five runs. Six is. It's one more. That's the first time in 21 games. The Blue Jays just barely, but do manage to take game one of this series against the Royals 6-5, getting back to 500, which I don't know about you, but to me, it's like there's a level of relief being at 500 or above. You know, like there's anxiety when you're below 500 in baseball, even if it's early in the season, but to get back to 500, considering you barely have to be above 500 to make the playoffs, Arizona Cardinals or Arizona Diamondbacks looking at you and your 84 wins last season. So, yeah, like, I don't know, karmically being at 500 is different.
Yeah, you just said Cardinals there, and now I can't think about Kyler Murray. I'm like, I wonder how good he actually was at baseball. And that's neither here nor there. Yeah, there should be. I just think that that what this team needs is so far beyond that that, yeah, I guess it's an exhale, but... But it's like you're drowning and you exhale for that half second. You go, and then you're just right back underwater and you're immediately fighting for your life again. So, yeah, I guess there's a little, you know, mental boost, or it's just nice to look at the standings and you don't have more in the loss column than in the win column. So I guess. But, yeah, I'm looking for a bar a touch higher than that. But, yeah, it's nice not to be below 500. I would agree with that, I guess.
Yeah, the bar is higher than just six runs in a baseball game as well, being a bottom five offense in all of baseball. But whatever, baby steps. So Yariel Rodriguez on a pitch count,
He gets undone a little bit in the first inning by some Addison Barger defense, which is, we can talk about Addison Barger. But yeah, the Blue Jays, without their two best relievers in Jimmy Garcia and Jordan Romano, who are out because they worked in back-to-back days, so they got to cobble it together.
Yep.
And somehow do, as Nate Pearson enters the game in the ninth inning as the closer, Eric Swanson, who has a little bit more experience in high leverage roles, he pitches the eighth inning and gives up another moonshot on one of those, you know, those splitters that didn't move. Anyways, he pitched around that and he was throwing upper 90s as well. And Nate Pearson, hey, he was going through the gut of the Royals order. And yeah, there was traffic on the bases, but he had to face Bobby Witt Jr., who's like the next star. He's the next one.
Next would imply it has yet to happen.
Bobby Witt Jr. hit a ground ball that for, I don't know, 99.999999% of baseball players is a double play. And he like was already like in right field as the ball hit. I was like, oh, you can't hit that harder, more directly at the shortstop. And like if everybody else, that's a double play. But it's like Bobby Witt Jr., not only is he a guy that has a 900 OPS, he's also the fastest player in the history of the sport, feels like.
I was going to say Bobby Witt Jr. is, and like there are a few guys in this club, like, you know, Ellie De La Cruz, O'Neill Cruz, Bobby Witt Jr. They're like the StatCast darlings. And I don't say that to begrudge the player. That sounds like it's like, oh, StatCast loves them, but real baseball fans.
Ellie De La Cruz has like all the stolen bases and all the home runs has done.
The reason why I say that, though, is I mean that they are the guys that are the that are buoyed the most by having the ability. We could just say, 15 years ago, we'd just say Bobby Witt Jr.'s fast, but now we can say, like, to a percentile, he is this fast. And, like, I'd say that with the arm speed with De La Cruz and the speed as well with him. So,
if he was a left-handed hitter, it would be just tempting not to just, I mean, the power is ridiculous, too, but it'd be tempting not just lay down a bunt. Like, every time. You couldn't beat him to first base, no matter how perfect your play
was. First.
Well, that's as close as you can get.
I know.
And we've seen the Billy Hamilton of it all. Anyways, Nate Pearson has to face a guy in Salvador Perez who was coming off the bench. He had back spasms, but has as many RBIs this season as the top three in the Blue Jays order combined.
Okay.
He is a human being.
Yeah.
He had 24. Anyways, pitches around him, despite the fact that he singles to left field on what was a pretty good slider. Nate Pearson also hit 101 in that inning.
You know me. I love triple digits.
One-run ball game in a season in which the Blue Jays have high expectations. Second career save. Hey, it's not what we wanted when we thought about Nate Pearson and the potential of him and when he was the top prospect in Major League Baseball. You're like, well, there's the next Roy Halladay, right? This is a 30-start-a-season guy who's going to be competing for Cy Youngs. And he's not that. And who knows if he's even this high leverage reliever guy, because he hasn't really been that on a consistent basis.
Yep.
I went back and looked at the first save, by the way. It was last season in July. It was also a one-run game, but it was against the White Sox, who were 37-52 at the time. So not exactly the same type of deal. And who knows where the Royals finish at the end of the season. I think they're a more capable team than last year's White Sox team. And I think just by the numbers, the best moment of Nate Pearson's career. I mean, if you told...
Second best. I was in, like, mop-up duty, but he strikes out five of the six batters he faces in his postseason debut. That, like, I understand what you're saying.
No, I disagree.
It's April.
Nah, I disagree. I'm, like, in a COVID season in which, you're playing a weird 2 out of 3 postseason series against the Rays in which you lost and you got into the game, and it was like, hey, give us one reason for optimism in a two-game series in which Bo Bichette's committing errors all over the place, and Hyunjin Ryu, despite having a Cy Young type season, you know, came unglued, and it was like, hey, at least we had the Nate Pearson thing. Now, this is the best moment of his career.
Go ask Nate Pearson, would you rather have a save in April or strike out 5 of 6 in your postseason debut? Like, see, we can say it in different ways to make, like, I agree with what you're saying, that stakes-wise, okay, I guess this means more because that was mop-up duty, but the idea of, and you got to remember, this was Nate Pearson then. The die's a little more cast now. Then you're sitting there going, because that was the thing I was thinking about. Not that I expected him to have 20 saves or something, but when they said this is his chance for his second, I was like, oh, that is lower than I would have expected. Imagine going back to yourself in 2022 when, again, in mop-up duty, and it doesn't matter, and they probably shouldn't even put it on his baseball reference page because it matters so little. But imagine going back to him or yourself or the Jays then saying, over under,
2.5 career saves. What are you taking on it? And they go, I think the over, probably. It's jarring how things change and expectations change, but love what you saw out of him last night.
Yeah, and maybe a step in the right direction. And Jordan Romano, there's no reason that, he's the unquestioned closer for this baseball team. Yep. He's been
so much so that even in blowouts against the Dodgers, they get the closer stuff going.
Yeah, that was weird. I don't know. I guess it's written into his contract that he has to have that when he comes out of the bullpen. Anyways, at least now he has some institutional knowledge. Like, Nate Pearson has something he can fall back on if, in fact, he's asked to do the same thing. I think if Jimmy Garcia is available and Jordan Romano's not, it's probably Jimmy Garcia getting that opportunity. But then you have another guy that's capable, and Chad Green obviously is also capable when he gets himself off the IL. Anyways, well done by Nate
Pearson. Just one last, I know we want to talk offense, but quickly, it can't be overstated how important it is to have some other guys, and Garcia can't overstate what he's meant in this. But if Pearson can throw himself into the mix here, can't overstate what it means with Swanson really not finding it this year. We know how bullpens go. We know how capricious it can be. It's entirely possible you've lost your setup, man, but there are plenty of capable options there, be it Green, Garcia, whoever.
No, I think the Blue Jays bullpen, I mean, they started the season without their closer and their setup, man, and it hasn't cost them. I think there was
I'm not going to say there's only one game the Pens cost them, but there's one, I can't remember the particulars of it, but it was a day where there was no Garcia available and they had to go to Swanson.
Yeah. I mean, they couldn't close it out against the Yankees third game of that series as they looked for the sweep. Anyways, Justin Turner, 2 home runs. He's been refried ridiculous to start the season, now hitting a robust .311 with a .390 on base and a .533 slugging percentage. I think this is the best start for a new Blue Jay in recent memory. So, Brandon Belt finished the season great last year. Horrible start. Marcus Semien set the record for home runs hit by a second baseman. In April, he had an OPS of .658. Kevin Kiermaier is close because that was a guy with low expectations. I was like, they're going to play this guy every day?
Right.
He hit close to .300 in April and was hitting .300 in the late stages of April last season while playing his ridiculous Gold Glove defense. In fact, in the home opener, you know, the first game with the new cutout in center field, steals a home run. The only other guy I think that has a case, I think he's got a good case. It's hard to compare pitchers to position players. Kevin Gausman didn't issue a walk until his 6th start as a Blue Jay. do we remember that?
That's absurd.
It was like, oh my God, this guy's never going to walk anybody. And of course, was a top 10 American League Cy Young Award candidate that season. But the start for him, it was like, oh my God, the Blue Jays not only spent this money wisely, but they've got the best pitcher maybe in the history of the sport. And obviously walked a few more and, you know, was undone by his defense. And the metrics were better than even the on-field results. The on-field results were really good. But, I mean, in recent memory, I don't know if there's been an off-season acquisition that's off to a better start than what Justin Turner's given you through a month now.
So I don't know if this is recent. I literally just pulled these numbers up in front of me. If this is recent enough for you, can I give you Josh Donaldson's April and March in his first season?
Yeah, I kind of view that as
it's different. It's a trade. It's...
No, but I honestly, that's like a different era.
That's fair.
Like, I mean, in the Vlad and Bo eras, but you're right. You're right to bring it up. So give me a start.
5 homers, 16 ribby, 7 walks, hit .319, .370 OBP, 550 slug, a nice little tidy .920 OPS. He followed up the next month with a over 1,000 OPS while driving in 23 runs and 10 homers. So you're right. Like, it is, there is a clear as day. It's not that long ago in the grand scheme of things. Like, we're not a decade removed from that, but there is a clear era delineation point there. So no, fair to bring it up. But if we're going to talk about guys who came in and treated it like the get it done league, it was Josh Donaldson.
No doubt. And that's why it was unbelievable that through 100 games that season, 101, they were 50-51. It was like, oh my God, they're going to have this middle of the lineup and they're going to miss the playoffs yet again. They didn't.
He's so good.
He was a spectacular Blue Jay. Addison Barger, congrats to him, gets his first hit. As I mentioned, had the tough defensive start at the beginning of the first inning. It was great to see him unleash the throw from third base. Yeah, that's for real, it seems. The cannon of an arm and like the hardest throw ever made by a Blue Jays outfielder in the StatCast era. And yesterday, rushing it up to almost 100 miles an hour from third base, that's cool. Be nice if yeah, he found himself a defensive position where you weren't, like, closing your eyes when a ball came his way. It's also nice that, like, I do think he's been unlucky to start his major league career offensively. I think there's been a couple of at-bats, and I'm thinking
the
fly ball to center field, his first at-bat in Kansas City, goes almost 400 feet. But, yeah, if you're not getting even, like, league average defense out of the dude, like, eventually the hits are going to have to start to fall for him. So good that he's on the board at least.
Yeah, I was going to say, leave him alone. You're talking like he didn't get his first knock last night. I will say it was the most excited, like everyone's excited to get their first knock. And I know it's part of like his identity, right? Is like a hustle effort guy, and he's got very toolsy, he's fast, got the big arm. That's the most aggressive turnaround first on a clear as day. No, of course, like you want it, but it was just, get back. I did have a second where I'm like, oh, God, don't get thrown out at first, taking a super big turn there.
And lastly, Danny Jansen also with a home run yesterday.
Slammo Jano.
Yeah. So he's off to a tremendous offensive start. I kind of feel like he was not the forgotten man. We did talk about him plenty, especially with Alejandro Kirk's slow offensive start.
It's impossible to do a show with me and bring up the Blue Jays and have me not shoehorn Jansen in. So we definitely mentioned him.
We should have been all over yesterday on the Wake and Rake on Danny Jansen goggle day that he was obviously going to go yard.
Yeah.
Well done by you, Danny Jansen. But this is a guy who yesterday was hitting fifth with no Bo Bichette in the lineup. But, man, a huge, huge part of the Blue Jays' offense, especially considering if Alejandro Kirk is not going to be the guy of old. I know he's coming off his first home run of the season, maybe a jumping off point for him, but man, and a kind of a forgotten part of the Blue Jays offense, at least for me, for the first 2 months of the season, especially considering this is a guy, and I'm not saying that there's like a higher level of effort, but we just see this in all sports, guys going into their free agent years, that it just so happens that generally they have one of the best seasons of their entire career.
See Judge Aaron, see Nylander William. Yeah, it is funny, though, the way it works out. And honestly, on a team that just lacks pop, like there's clearly pop to be had. Look at your Davis Schneider, Turner going deep twice. But, man, there's clear as day a role for him in this lineup. And, you know, I don't want to, you know, take too negative a turn here, but despite the great offensive night, 1-for-11 runners in scoring position last
night. Yeah, man. No, to me, the way I view that is actually a positive, that you win games where you can't, and they're still hitting as a team for the season under the Mendoza line with runners in scoring position. And are they going to be a great team hitting with runners in scoring position? No. But are they going to hit with runners in scoring position the same way they're hitting without runners in scoring position, which is still not great, but it's better than under the Mendoza line? I do. And look, I know people made a big deal, and rightly so, about the lack of production with runners in scoring position the first half of last season. That normalized. That did. The thing we all said would happen did happen in the second half of the season. I think it's actually a tremendous thing that you can win a baseball game while you're still hitting under 200 with runners in scoring position, because that's going to happen. It might take until June or July. By that point, you might be 10 games under 500. They're going to hit better than 190, whatever, with runners in scoring
position. This also seemed very obvious, but I should just mention it. That's what happens when you hit home runs, is that you can kind of paper over a terrible night at the dish with runners in scoring position because a few balls just go over the fence and you kind of take care of your own business there. It's kind of the point of having
home runs
pop.
Are good.
Yeah, home runs are good. I know. I honestly
kill the rally, though.
Oh, that's a good point. Like, what was Justin Turner thinking, killing two rallies last night?
Too many rallies murdered in cold blood yesterday. All right, when we come back, it looks like there's going to be a changing of the guard between the pipes tonight for the Toronto Maple Leafs in Game 5. How significant a story has the goaltending been in this series from the Maple Leafs perspective, and Steven Stamkos perhaps done as a member of the Tampa Bay Lightning? That and more next as the Fan Morning Show continues. Ben Ennis, Brent Gunning, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.